welcome to my podcast, Susie Explores, a podcast with me, Susie Collier. Today, my guest is the wonderful Fred Harris, director of countless ensembles and senior lecturer at MIT in Boston. We enjoyed a fascinating conversation delving into what it takes to make the moment, the essence of humour, and how to ignite the imagination. Do you know something? We are in touch quite a lot of the time, and we'll just send each other just a tiny message that just might be just conveying some joy or a thought. And especially around Christmas time, we were in touch, and it's always such a lovely thing. But I was thinking back to really when we first met, and I guess, Fred, we're going back to 2018. Do you think that's right?
Yes. Oh, I remember you walking down hall of Kresge, and immediately there was some connection. I don't know how it happened, but I remember it distinctly.
And that's a really strange thing, isn't it? Because you can never predict when or where or how you have a kind of a connection with somebody. But it honestly was just there. We didn't have to try. There was no politeness or extra special behavior. It was just there. And it was, I think, right in the middle of a crazy rehearsal that you were having with Jacob. Or maybe he wasn't even there yet. I can't even remember. Maybe it was just us rehearsing.
He was there, actually, because I remember, the other thing I remember is he immediately came off the stage and made a beeline to you. And it was as if you hadn't seen him in 15 years or something. But of course, it was probably 6 months or whatever.
Yes, but, I think it had been a long time. We were very pleased to see each other. And in fact, what I had done is that the cab had taken me to the wrong building. I'd come into JFK, to the wrong building. I went into the building opposite and the guy said, oh, well, look, let's go all the way down this corridor. And you know what it's like, it's just these long corridors at MIT.
Went all
the way down the end. And they helped me with this big suitcase. And we got to the other end and realized that we were in the wrong building. So they wheeled it all the way back again, took it down the steps and made sure I was in the right building. And they were so kind to me, but I was absolutely, I felt two things. One is that I was unbelievably tired because I just had a long haul flight. But on the other hand, I felt so excited just walking into Kresge Hall and seeing what was happening. There was no doubt in my mind that it was going to really work out, not just fine, but be the most inspirational experience, really. How do you look back on that time? Because so Jacob was musician in residence, wasn't he?
Yes. And actually, it was almost a 2 week period that we had, which was very unusual. And at the time, it was, I remember Ben saying, well, you know, it's very rare that this happens. But it was partly because it was the new band. And this was an opportunity. Not only was it the official record release of Jesse One, but it was the first time that the band was coming together. So they wanted to have time for them to gel as an ensemble. So that's why that extra week was built in. So it was just special to have, because in 2016, we had just a week. And we had more time. And my memories, I mean, it's just such a vivid, every aspect of it is still deep in my bones. And I remember when it came about that, what do you think about my mom coming? And I thought, fantastic. That would be the best thing ever. And I didn't know if it was going to happen. And then you walked in. And what I loved is you immediately assessed what was necessary, what wasn't necessary. And we didn't have to talk about it.
We didn't have to talk about it. That's really true. I think there's always been a real honesty between us. So I don't think either of us are afraid to say anything to the other. And it can springboard into some kind of spark of inspiration that just takes us further, or it stops us from wasting time and really thinking about things in a way that perhaps isn't so helpful at the time. But I remember thinking then, and I have thought so on all the subsequent times that I have seen you, that you really know how to spin plates. And I think spinning plates is quite a thing. But I think of you, and I think of you with wonderful Becky and your wonderful girls, your beautiful family at home. I think of you with all the different projects that you embrace and create, initiate, carry forward at MIT, besides anything else you do to link up the world and everybody in it. So what say you? Spinning plates? Are you good at it?
Well, I do it, that's for sure. It's not easy, I will say that. And it takes a lot of mental energy. Mm. and lots and lots of lists. I have lists upon lists upon lists. I think you maybe function that way too. And I have to be on paper. And I think it's just a matter of keeping the mind. I think what takes so much work is that it's not just making things happen. It's the thought behind them, the intention behind something. And that's what is so exhaustive and emotionally taxing. And yet you can't do it any other way, right? I mean, because I was thinking about this and knowing we're going to have this conversation and things that we have in common. And I think one thing that's similar is that when you go into something, whether it's a one-on-one conversation, whether it's a lesson with one or two people, chamber ensemble, or a full group, we're going all in mentally and emotionally, going all in. And that takes a lot of energy, putting yourself out like that. But we can't do it any other way, right? So when you're spinning all those plates, that's the only problem I find, is that how much of your capacity you want to, you can't function in a way that is not true to yourself.
No.
So when you do that, how many satellites are you putting out there, and what can you handle? You know, so that's, I think it's a matter of being true to yourself and being true to your emotional investment in whatever you're doing. And trying to balance that with many things can be challenging unless, you know, you can carve out the time in your heart and mind to keep it going.
I think you're really right. And I think the idea of being true to yourself is a really important one. I love the fact that you say it may be in a rhetorical kind of a way. Well, how many satellites can we get out there? And I think what I was thinking before our conversation was the idea that I didn't think about it in satellites, but I love that idea. You know, you're putting these things out there and we're going to see what's happening. And we've got an intention behind them. But I think there has to be just a time and a space in yourself to be able to take on a new satellite and launch it, even when it's a surprise. So I understand what you mean about having, you know, the thing is, we're writing all these lists, and you and I both, when we've seen each other and we're trying to carve something, we'll both have hundreds of small pieces of paper on which we're writing bits and pieces, some of which we lose, right? And we're both exactly the same in that way, which is really hilarious in many ways. But you can't prepare for everything. And sometimes an opportunity comes along, doesn't it, Fred? And you just think, well, I can't just put that aside and say, this is convenient for tomorrow. I have to think about this now. And there's no doubt, is there? You're just going to give your everything.
That's right. And that speaks to the thing that's not often connected to all of this, you know, spinning plates, organization. Yes. But there's two things I think of connected to that. One is the mental energy to just think, to sit quietly and think about something.
Yeah.
That is a precious thing. And I think anybody who's creative, and certainly you can speak to Jacob and your daughters, when they're creating something, there's a lot of quiet in my room doing my own thing for hours and hours. And I think that's a great gift of all children need to have, time alone. And I think as artists, that's something that's so crucial. Because it takes time to think, and you need to be quiet. And the other aspect that you're talking about now, which is absolutely crucial, is spontaneity.
Yes.
Being open to spontaneity.
Yes.
And I believe that spontaneity is connected to imagination. And I know when I've watched you work with small groups and ensembles, and I feel the same way. There has got to be spontaneity in music making or any creative act, or else, you know, it doesn't go anywhere. It's not alive and fresh. So I think you're exactly right. I mean, those two elements are crucial to the art.
Okay. I think you're putting things just incredibly well. This is a good day. This is a good day for a conversation. It's really happening in there. You talk about spontaneity and you talk about things being alive and fresh. But I want to put one more ingredient in there, which is that if we're saying, yes, 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 bring it on, I'm always open to a bit of spontaneity and here's an idea. Okay, I'm going to run with it. The other thing perhaps that we need besides a sense of curiosity is a lack of fear or fearlessness, to put it in a more positive way.
Yes, that's so. And that too takes emotional and intellectual girth, so to speak, you know, because anytime you're trying to be fearless in something, there's always going to be elements pushing at you and saying, no, 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 you shouldn't do that. They might be benign elements you feel, say in a rehearsal, or they might be structural, the machine of where you are or what you're doing. And I think one has to, if you're dealing with creativity and the arts and most importantly, connecting to other human beings in that way, you have got to have that fearless element and be willing to risk, right? Mm. And risk involves vulnerability. So I think if we're going to be fearless, we have to say, you know what? I'm ready to fail. I'm ready to put myself out there and I'm going to make mistakes, but I rather do that than just have flatline. You know, the person's gone.
Well, flatline is certainly a way to exist. It's just I'm not quite so sure how fulfilled a life it is. And I know that sometimes it's easy to just feel that we're kind of asking the universe for a bit of flatline, but actually we're not really asking for flatline. We're asking for quiet alone time. And that's a different kind of a thing. And I think it's so important that we perceive the difference between flatline existence and one that has some quiet in it, because they are profoundly different. And yet, yes, at face value, in one sense, they seem as though they have some things in common. I mean, the thing is that you talk about risk, and there is risk in fearlessness, and you talk about a vulnerability, because we're sure as hell not going to get it right the whole time. And no. I know that. But I also wonder, really, whether it's also to do with parking the ego, so that it's not about how this is going to forward my career, or how it's going to benefit me, or how it makes me look in a situation. I think when you really grasp an idea and just embrace it rather than grasp it, actually, because an idea has come to you or somebody said, how about this? It's about enabling that idea to be a satellite and to really reflect out, soak in, and spark all sorts of experiences. But I think the ego is a bit of a tricky one.
It is. No, that's, I love what you just said, because I think the ego and the meanness of anything you're trying to do is what takes away from it. And yeah, we've all seen situations where that happens. I think how I try to see it is I'm just a vessel. I have to be strong. I have to lead. But I was just having an ensemble experience last week. And I said in kind of exasperation, but also in trying to, you know, move things forward and keep it alive, because I was feeling it was flatline. I said, my goal, I was conducting an ensemble. I said, my goal is to be diminished. I don't want to be present in a sense. I want to be a great listener. So I said, your goal is to play so well that I'm not important anymore.
Yes.
And so I kind of went down as if I could, you know, I go completely away. And I said, that's really, and I'm serious about that. It doesn't mean that I don't care. It doesn't mean that you're on your own. It just means that you've taken ownership. I've provided this menu and I've guided it creatively and all of that. But ultimately, I want to hear what you do with that menu, because it's more interesting to me. And people think, you know, the whole conducting thing and play like this, play like that. Mm. Yes, you have to have an idea. You have to have a vision and imagination of how the music goes. But in the best possible situation, I've seen you do this as well. All of a sudden, that violist, that clarinet player plays a phrase and an idea that you hadn't thought of, which is great.
Yes.
And you immediately say, let's all do that. This yes. is wonderful. Mm. And so I've just provided the vessel for that. You know, the atmosphere, you know, where people can feel comfortable. That's all important. That takes a lot of energy mm-hmm. too, to have an environment that's welcoming, that is not threatening, where ultimately, and this is hard, where the other people can feel vulnerable.
Yes.
They can't feel vulnerable to take risks unless you show that you're able to, if you don't show your real self. Once you do that, it still isn't easy, because everybody's in a different place, especially when you're dealing with younger people. But I would argue even with older, mature musicians.
Absolutely. I've got it. I see where you're coming from. And the thing is that when you're talking about providing a menu, or you're providing a lead or some ideas, and then where actually you're saying that you're involving others and listening to others in a really, really acute kind of a way, then the thing is that we do find that energy doesn't just come from within. Energy comes from absolutely everybody who is around you. And I think it's not about pointing the finger and saying, well, you all need to take responsibility for your actions. It's more kind of, I want to feel that I have a responsibility within this ensemble because I want to be here and I feel key to being able to give something and I am worthy of being here. And so then that comes back to your idea of, do you know something? We need to make people feel comfortable and welcomed so that they in turn can feel vulnerable. And I just love that because in a sense, it's like riding on a Segway, which kind of keeps going once you've got the momentum going. And right. In that you've got the idea of, well, I'm just going to say, look, it's really great to see you. We're going to approach this piece. I don't know all the answers about it yet, but I want to explore it with you. Mm-hmm. And so our vulnerability then goes over to them and they say, well, I don't think that worked like that. Could we maybe try it like this? Or how about that? And then suddenly there's not just two-way energy, but as many people in the room as possible. You've got right. all those arrows, true satellite style. Whoa, yes. Here we go, like this.
Yes, right.
But in order to allow the satellite to work, and I think we've just had one failed attempt to put one in the way up high. The idea started in the UK and it's kind of finished in the UK. But, you know, the idea is that the folks behind that idea wanted to make sure that we learn more and we glean more. And that satellite potentially was just open to whatever came its way. So
right.
I think the idea that we're not being threatening is a really big thing. But I want to know how you enabled that particular thing to happen. Because I think it's one thing to say, I don't want to be threatening and I don't want you to be frightened of me. I don't want you to feel like I'm just in charge and you're just the minions. But how do you actually really enable folks to realize it's a non-threatening situation to be in your ensemble?
I think it's a great question. And I have thought about it. I haven't thought about it in the sense of I will do it this way. It just has evolved naturally over the years.
Okay.
And I think, if I want to be completely honest about it, I think that it's not just about, it's a great way to be in life. I don't succeed, but whether it's a family unit or with friends, this, what I'm about to say, I think is something that can be very good for creating a non-threatening environment.
Yeah.
Yes, it involves vulnerability, but I think I find humor is a fantastic tool. I use it all the time, to be honest, as stress release.
Yes.
Humor is a wonderful tool, especially when you're in, let's face it, you know, you're in a situation where maybe it is somebody you don't know, or you're, even in your family, things can come up, but we'll use the ensemble as a sense. I think of that as a family anyway.
Yes.
In those situations, you know, you're trying to put something together. There's a deadline. There's only so much time. There are all these elements that are coming at you. And I think when you can use humor, you take away the time. You take away the fact that there's a concert that we're preparing for.
Absolutely, yes.
And I actually joke, I just did the other day, joked and said, you know what, everybody? And they looked at me, I'm not really interested in concerts. What? We're not. I said, I'm interested in what we do. I mean, I like them. It's nice to invite people to come. We dress up, blah, blah, blah. But what I'm interested in is what we do every time we get together. The
yes.
concert is just one of those times.
Yes.
In my mind, every single time we get together is a concert. Because it's a celebration of life and music. Because my God, what's the percentage of the world that actually sits down, sings, and plays together of the entire world? It should be much higher than it is. And would probably solve a lot of the world's problems if more people were. But to get back to the point, I do use humor because humor is a universal, it's a universality.
Yes.
And you have to be careful with it. You know, you have to make it. I use a lot of self-deprecating humor because then I'm the object of it. I use analogy all the time.
Yes.
Analogy. And I use analogy all spontaneously. I don't practice the analogy. And they're all, and you do this as well. And the analogies, more times than not, are humorous in some way.
Yes.
Sound as if you're lifting up a blue whale. Imagine what that feels like to lift a blue whale, the heaviest animal. Now put that, you know, those kinds of things. And I think that kind of, that's an important thing. And then I think the other thing probably is in the act of making music, connecting to one another, I think it's absolutely key that everybody sees that you are full in and passionate to the degree that you will, within reason, do whatever it takes to make a moment happen, to make a moment happen, to capitalize in that moment. Who cares if you were supposed to start, you were supposed to do the Elgar at 10:10. If I have a chance to work on this 4-3 suspension chord so everybody can go, then I don't care if I start the Elgar at 10:35.
That's right.
You know, so I think that those two things, I think, tend to be, you know, the humor aspect, and then really letting yourself go emotionally as to what you're doing. So they see that passion. I think everybody in the world needs to see somebody who's passionate about something. And I think what ties into that for me, which is another topic maybe, which is how the imagination, how your imagination ignites passion.
But if we think about how imagination does actually ignite, then we have to, I think, perhaps think about the idea of curiosity in a major way.
Yeah.
Because I think that if you are allowed to be curious and to just say, hey, I'm not going to start the Elgar until 10, whatever it is, because here's an idea and this has just happened, then you're really allowing yourself, or you're allowing the ensemble, to run with a creative idea to see what's going to happen. And I think if we are curious, we can look at this little idea that's running along, and we can look at it from all sorts of different perspectives and find ways in. And we might have 100 different ways of how to develop that idea, if in fact we are allowed to be imaginative. But the moment you say, as the MD, well, that's obviously not going to work, so we're not going to try your idea there, or you were wrong, we can't do it in this way, or we haven't got time for that right now, we have a concert in 2 weeks, do you not understand? Right. We can't be experimenting with this kind of stuff right now. Now, we've all had that, we've all experienced that, and I can see exactly why folks can say those kinds of things, because it's a different kind of a stress, isn't it?
Yes.
And it's kind of a quest to keep order and control, because it's safer. I'm the person in charge, and I'm going to feel so much more safe if I can do it within the confines of what I know. Mm-hmm. But actually, counterintuitively, the moment I let go of that and think, well, maybe someone's going to look at this and think it's a bad rehearsal. Well, but that doesn't matter. Maybe the people in the ensemble are going to think I'm bonkers if I suggest this. If instead we are completely and utterly committed to that moment,
right,
then perhaps there is a way to kind of not have any of those conversations going on at all, but to really literally let yourself go or be completely and utterly committed to exploring the idea, even though you have no idea, or there might be an instinct, but you really don't have any guarantee about how it's going to turn out.
Exactly. No, I think that's beautifully said, and I think it's a matter of approach. Are you getting together? Is the goal to make music every time you take the instrument out of the case, you stand on that riser to sing? Or is it to prepare something? Is it to prepare? I mean, yes, we're getting together to say, I mean, music is performance, right?
Yes.
So we don't want to take that away. But what's our value system of our getting together? What's the point of it? If it's just to prepare something, I mean, you know, let's face it, performance is usually one time, especially, I mean, even professionals, they might get 3 shots at it. It's ephemeral. It's wonderful. It needs to be spontaneous. It needs to be different than what you did to be great. It needs to not be the same thing you rehearsed. Let's do it exactly the same way. No, that's you know, awful. No matter what level, younger children, I believe that, which a lot of people think that's strange, but you've got some level. I mean, within reason, right? There's always got to be some spontaneity. But I think what happens during the rehearsal, the best case situation is you capitalize on those moments like you were talking about. You have an environment where you welcome people's ideas and you highlight them. Sally, can you play that phrase? David, could you do it as well? Ahmad, can you do it too? Oh, listen to how they all did it differently. Isn't that beautiful? Now, that might take me 7 minutes, but where I could have done the 16th notes at letter B or whatever. But what that shows the students is that you value their creativity.
Yes.
And I think when we deal with largely, especially in an ensemble setting, we're dealing with a recreative art. The more we can get creativity into the recreative art, well, that's artistry.
It is, but it seems to be that it's such an easy thing to forget. When you say it, it sounds so straightforward. When you explain that we need to value their creativity in the same way that they might be valuing your creativity, I think that's a really huge thing. And I think it doesn't necessarily fit into societal norms. And so what we're trying to convey in those rehearsals may be a different way of thinking and feeling and being. And it may contrast a lot of the rest of their lives. So we're all taking a chance, but perhaps what we don't realize is that they're taking a bigger chance than we are because they don't necessarily live in that way the whole time. Whereas the Fred I know is going to be exactly the same when he goes home to Becky and the girls, when they're discussing where to go at the weekend. It's going to be exactly the same thing. You're going to behave in the same way. So I think it's just suddenly come to me now that we need to be respectful of the fact that it could be really difficult to basically be encouraging our students to trust, to really live in the moment right now and to know that they have got an opinion and they have got a feeling about it, even if they just think, oh, I don't know. They do know. And that most of the questions that they're asking, they actually have the power to be able to answer those questions. But I think it's a tricky thing to navigate. And I think we've got to realize that if, in fact, we are trying to direct an ensemble in that kind of a way, that it could be very unfamiliar to some of those students and that we really need to be very respectful of that. And again, non-judgmental.
Yes. And you've hit upon, which is a hugely important point. And I will readily admit where I have failed at times, maybe every day in some ways, who knows? But it is basically empathy and putting yourself in other people's shoes. And we say it, and we like, as humanity, we love the idea, and the word has gotten much more. If we were to do some Google search, we'd find that the word empathy has risen. However, putting it into practice on a daily basis is hard. It's hard work. And it's not that we're not caring, feeling for people, but exactly what you said. And in fact, I'll admit to you, I in this same rehearsal I told you about, I had a colleague who was there, a wonderful music education colleague there to help me and to support me. And I was saying to him, oh, I think I'm failing, you know, this such and such, blah, blah, blah. I don't know if I'm. And he said, Fred, you've got to realize where they're coming from. You're offering this plate. And they're not used to many of these things that you live this way, but this is new to them. Mm. And even though I intellectually, yes, I know that, it's another thing to put yourself actually in their shoes. I mean, real empathy, like imagining, no, I am 17, I am 15, and I'm coming once a week, and this crazy man is in front of me. going out into the hall and saying, send your sound out there and running around without his shoes on. I think that that's really important. And I think I can say that as a human being, anytime I fail at human communication, which I think is the hardest thing ever, is because of that forgetting of the empathy, whether it's forgetting of where the person you're interacting is coming from. Doesn't have anything to do with whether you agree with them. It shouldn't have anything to do with whether you're getting what you perceive as negativity coming at you.
No.
Put yourself in that, whatever the age, whatever. It's really hard to do that. But that is, to me, that's the whale. That's the hardest thing to do consistently. And I've kind of come up with all these kinds of things in my head to try to have these approaches that I use to think about. But do I always do them? No. And then I have to analyze, well, why did I fail? I take the time to say, well, why did I fail that way? Oh, it usually comes back to a similar thing. So, you know, we humans, we like to fall into patterns, don't we? So to break a pattern is it takes a lot of work.
I love the fact that you have interacted with somebody else who has said a similar thing to you, because it really shows me that it's a thing. And it's not just a thing, but it's a thing that we really need to respect and really understand and remind ourselves. It's not a lesson you just learn once. You have to think about it every single time you interact with somebody. What I'm finding interesting, though, is that, and I think it was just a word of convenience, but you said, you know, when you feel you have failed, it's because you have not, you've forgotten the empathy. You've forgotten to kind of engage with that. But I'm not that keen on the word fail. And I wonder whether it is just a case of, you know, something, it's when something that you were expecting to happen or wanting to happen just didn't quite. And that could have been a really good thing in the long run. It could have been very uncomfortable and unhelpful in the short term. But did it mean you failed? It's a pretty damning phrase. It's a bit of a damning kind of concept here. I think really that you needed to be reminded, to be curious enough in the other person who you're ministering to really find out, honestly, where are they coming from right now? Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, I think it's a very personal thing. I think a lot of people do like the word fail, but it seems a bit harsh.
I agree. Thank you for saying that, because it also speaks to something that's also always in my head and I'm always talking about, is words are important. What we say is really important, and how we say it. The words we choose and the how is also an area of I won't say the word failure, is also an area of growth. Yes. How we say things is what we say, the words we choose, and how we choose to say them is an area of challenge for humanity. It's certainly an area of challenge for me. And I think it's really important. It's really important. So I love the idea. Let us now decree at this time, 9:38 Eastern Standard Time, to not use the word failure. Because, you know, the other problem with failure, as you were saying that, is that it invites guilt, being a martyr, you know, it invites beating up on yourself.
Yes, it does.
It's like that, you know, when you're feeling sad about something and you wallow in it, which, you know, we as humans do, it's kind of like that. It's that word. So let's get rid of it.
Well, we can right now. I think, you know, it's a bit like, you know, why do wasps exist in life? I think, you know, sometimes we just have to think, well, I could really engage with that. And sometimes you just need to say, I don't understand why, but I'm going to park it. And maybe there are times when it is suitable to use that word or use it within a phrase. But I'm thinking about what you've just said, which is that it's what we say and how we say it. Mm-hmm. And I think that comes back to your idea of intention, because I think how we say something needs to be with care, but it needs to be with intention. And if that intention is not genuine, then it's going to be completely transparent. So I think that if you really are feeling that somebody could give something another go, then that's because you've gone to their shoes. You're thinking about what it might feel like to them if you say, could you try that again? You're really genuinely saying it because you really believe truly that it could improve their understanding of something. And the other thing is that you're getting rid of your own expectation of a result. Mm-hmm. Because then it becomes really frisky. It becomes really kind of exciting, because as long as you don't mind being wrong, so-called wrong,
right,
it doesn't matter, does it?
No. And I think I like to use the word expectation, because expectations, sometimes they can be associated with the word standards, which is a loaded word sometimes too. And I think that we must, I mean, I do believe that there is a certain level. Again, I'm going with this. I don't want to have any engagement in music, whether the person is 7 years old or 70 years old, that it feels like this.
No.
So it's important that there is some, for me, the baseline is emotional engagement. That's the baseline. However, we have to be careful with that idea of expectations and being open to that, what's in your head of what the expectation or what the experience is, whether it's a conversation, you have to be open to it going in a different direction and being okay with that. That said, it's still, I think, okay to have some baseline. If we were having this conversation now and you were asking me where I was born, and which is fine, but you know, you were talking, asking, you know, reading from the paper, and
yes,
it would be hard for me. My expectations would change and I would be as polite as I can be. But
yes.
You know what I'm saying?
I do know what you're saying. I think it's important to say, though, that if we're saying that emotional engagement is our baseline, again, I think I would need to remind myself that somebody might engage emotionally and really have a go at me, or they might really say, I don't like that. And that's because they are emotionally engaging with what you have just asked them. It doesn't mean it's all to do with you, but
exactly.
They have definitely engaged. They are in the moment. They are feeling what they're feeling for whatever reason, and they are expressing it. So what do we do in that situation?
Yeah, that's wonderful. Exactly. Because the emotional engagement, you're exactly right. It isn't all about your perception of it. Totally.
No.
You know, no, it's about your, I mean, the short of what you just said is, in a sense, ideally, I'd rather have some kind of, have the person feel something rather than nothing.
Yes.
Now, if that, what is felt is sort of what I feel is, I don't like what you're bringing to this experience, and that's giving me a certain feeling. It's good to know that, because if I'm really humble and practicing what I preach, I take that information, and I've had these experiences, I take that information and I say, you know what? I first off, I appreciate what you're saying, because this is good for me to know, because I wasn't aware.
Yes,
so thank
right.
you for yeah. letting me know that,
yes.
that what was going on did not make you feel comfortable. Thank you. Thank you. And then secondly, what do you think we could do that, how I could, you know, help you, or how could we connect that makes you feel more comfortable?
Yes.
You know, those are challenging conversations to have, but you've got to be open enough to have them. And again, it comes back to being willing to risk, and we won't say fail, but be willing to feel like you're being really challenged.
I do wonder, though, what we as human beings getting older in this world, with each year we get more experience of being with other people. We're so lucky, both of us, to have that experience. But what happens when that discussion is had, and then when we put the question, what can I do to actually make this feel more comfortable, more appropriate, more just better? If that person's really angry, there's a very small chance they'll just say, you can do nothing. The damage is done. That's it. And I'm going to slam the door. So in that situation, which thankfully is rare, but it can happen because we don't know exactly what's going on with another person or how they've received what you've given them. But how do you think we then take that? Because that's an unresolved situation. That's not somebody saying, Fred, thanks so much. I really didn't like it when you alluded to this in this particular way, and I found that uncomfortable. And you said, that's great. I really feel aware of that. Now, thank you so much for bringing that to my attention. That's a resolution in the kind of conventional sense. But what about those times when actually, we can't tidy it up and cross it off our lists because it's not resolved?
Yeah, this is a great topic, and one that I have certainly struggled with at times.
Mm.
I think, you know what I was thinking about when we talked about empathy, part of, step back just a little bit. I think there's something in my mind, I don't know if it makes sense or not, but visual empathy. And what I mean by that is, I think that I had this happen to me early in my teaching career, where the bottom line is, you never know what someone is thinking, and you can never know what's in someone else's head. So especially when we're engaged with standing in front of people, whether you're teaching a physics class or you're teaching an orchestra, or jazz ensemble, whatever it is, you can never know what is going on in someone's head.
No.
And you don't know what you're doing, how it's actually affecting the person, both positively and hopefully not, but even negatively.
But sometimes negatively, yes.
And sometimes negatively. So because of that, what I would say is, if one can try to create an atmosphere where everyone feels valued, it's idealistic, but I live in an ideal world. If I didn't, I'd go crazy. So I've got to at least imagine that everything is ideal and then do what I can to climb the mountain of it.
Yeah.
But I think that if you can create an atmosphere or a mountain that...
Yeah, whatever you want, it's okay.
Whatever you want, it's okay. That welcomes people's different views and feelings. In other words, you know, if I see somebody who looks visually like they are, do not want to be there at all, and I because of that react, you know, because I'm a human, I might be like, I might react to that somehow in some physical way, you know, whatever it is. And I mean, we're human. We, you know, if somebody is doing this, you know, we're going to react a certain way. Or if somebody's looking like this, you know, but I'll tell you a story. And this is not a tough story, but it happened a long time ago.
Okay.
So this was like 30 years ago, first teaching. And I actually said to a student, because I was, you know, trying to, so exasperated about this. And I said to the student, don't you care about this? You know, I said it like that. And the student paused and then said to me, you'll never know how much I care. And I was shocked because I felt horrible, but it was a good horrible because I was like, wow, what a lesson I just had. It was a great example of, I didn't know what was going on in his head. And just because physically he was manifesting in my mind, this is my bias, he was manifesting postures and behavior that said to me, I don't want to be here. Please get me out of here. That was my impression. So I did not have any visual empathy for what was going on with him. And so the lesson I took with that is that, you know, you have to be as careful with assessing someone, that's a horrible word, but, you know, your impressions, let's say, of someone.
Yes.
We have to be careful as human beings to not make any assumptions. And when we get into the business of creating art, it's a vulnerable thing. Yeah. It's a relationship. If we're going to have that baseline of emotional engagement, then we've got to, that's a different kind of relationship. And I want to have a relationship with that, with anybody I'm making music with. And to do that, that means you've got to take in where that person's at, respect it. And if you can help the person grow, or if that person, they always help me to grow as well. It's a reciprocal kind of thing. Doesn't matter ability or experience level. Everybody's growing from interaction with everybody.
Mm-hmm.
I think that at least may not eliminate what you're saying, but I think it makes it less likely to happen. But it takes a lifetime of engagement to get better at that.
I think so, but I still think I'm imagining the chap you're talking about of all those years ago, and I'm imagining, you know, a stance or a bit of an attitude pose.
Mm-hmm.
And that reminds me to come back to what we were talking about near the beginning, which is that if it's about me, then I'm going to feel offended.
Right.
I'm going to feel that I'm not respected. I'm going to feel I'm not understood. Whereas that person, however old or young they are, doesn't matter, but maybe that is the safest place for them to inhabit right now. And even though the expression on their faces are not changing when you'd expect them or hope that they would, actually there is a wonderful process going on inside, and something can melt at a later date. But if we think it's just all about us, oh, it's my fault, or I should be trying hard, or this person doesn't like me,
right?
Then we've brought in our own agenda. And I think it just becomes, that person just becomes smaller and smaller, and yet bigger and bigger in your mind, because you can see the attitude. Look, you can see the way that they're treating me. I've got every right to wonder whether they're committed at all. But actually, I don't think we do. And I like the idea, which has just come to me, of they become smaller by you making yourself bigger in that situation, or you make their facial expression into a big thing. That's actually making the human being inside so much smaller.
Exactly. I think it's, well, first off, when that student, when I think about it, I thought about it then, I've thought about it years since, the courage that it took for him to say that.
Unbelievable.
The courage
yes.
for him to say that was incredible. And after that moment, our relationship was fantastic. And he became the greatest supporter of, in his own way, and how he did it was, but the greatest supporter of anything that we were all doing, community. So I think what you said about the diminishing and all this stuff, I think it comes down to viewing yourself and you're dealing in an artistic or any kind of communication. Mm. You're a vessel as opposed to you're imposing or you're, you know, being a vessel for something is much different than, you know, dictating or having your own agenda. It takes the ego out of it.
It does. And actually, if we're talking about the kind of making big and making small, being a vessel is nothing to do with actually making yourself bigger or making yourself smaller. And I think it's a common belief that we should be making ourselves bigger in the world. And that's a really great thing. But it is also an idea that we make ourselves smaller in certain situations because we think that by diminishing ourselves, it makes room for other people to be bigger. But actually, I'm not sure that that is completely true. Because if you really are making yourself smaller and your ideas small and everything that you're giving in a smaller way because you think it might be handled better, it's not necessarily honest. And you can still be really sensitive, but you don't need to diminish yourself in order for that other person to be bigger. You just need to perhaps, I'm just experimenting with this right now. I think perhaps we just need to be really understanding where the ego is here. So when I say making yourself bigger, well, that's bigger in a situation where you inhabit the space. Mm-hmm. But if I deliberately make myself smaller, and yet I'm not really conveying what I want to convey to that person, it doesn't feel very honest somehow. Can you sense what I'm saying?
Yes, that's a wonderfully subtle point in all this that's hugely important. And coming back to that idea that I told the students that my goal is to have myself be smaller and mm-hmm. then you to be not as mm-hmm. important of having to put the music together. That doesn't take away the fact that somebody has to be the galvanizer, at least to the start. Someone
Absolutely.
Has to have
yes.
the, and you have to be true to that. And you have to, and that has to be, it has to have integrity and it has to have, you know, emotional connection also
yeah.
means that you have to know what you're doing. You
yeah.
have to know the craft, of course. You can't, you know, just,
yes.
I think what the, in this, in that situation, someone has to bring quality of preparation, quality of craft. And when you have that, then you can be open enough to allow yourself
yeah.
to let others take wings. But you still have to have that. It's almost like a fishing line. So if I throw a line out and I don't want to, I will release the fish. I'm not going to, but if I have the line out as just, or let's use a boat. So if I've got if there's a life raft out there and I've got a line to it, let's say that interaction I'm having is that life raft out there. They're in that boat. I've still got the line. I'm not yanking it. I'm holding it. It's taut. I'm still in it, but I'm not having to control it. And I'm liking the fact that they're figuring out they're having their own kind of life party out there. I'm just holding the line and I'm there and I'm grateful to be there. And I have some oversight,
yes.
you know, I mean, because what, you know, as I said, when I said I was diminishing myself to them, but I said, I'm listening like crazy. I am listening to you like crazy. And I'm in a position where I'm seated to be able to hear better than anyone else, the whole totality. So I want to be the best listener possible. So then I can say, oh, your color's wonderful. Why don't we bring it out just a little more? You took your time on that phrase. Let's all do that. I'm the one with that line to say, okay, listen, everybody, I'm pulling it. Do you hear? Sally's pulling that. Let's all do it together. And I think that's very important. So it's not as though it's exactly what you said. It's not as though you're saying, okay, you just take it, because that doesn't work at all.
No.
You know, you have, somebody has to lead, but it's how you lead and what do you bring to that leadership that allows others to take it and run with it.
I agree with that. Mm. And the thing is that I think that kind of leadership, in one sense, I do like the idea of the diminishing director getting smaller so that they take more responsibility. But you are being honest when you say that actually I've still got a tie to that life raft. Mm-hmm. And you're going to tie the ideas together of Sally or whoever it happens to be to just really make sure that it all works. So you're not really becoming smaller. You're enabling them to be bigger,
mm-hmm.
and take that responsibility. I love the idea of coming into the practicalities, because I think that maybe some people could listen to this and just think, this sounds very airy-fairy here, but sometimes we need to get a job done and we've got goals and we've got timetable to keep to. But you've just said that the quality of preparation and the quality of the craft that you are giving, there's no substitute for that in a sense. You have to bring to the table something that has been thought through and has been prepared. And in the same way that every rehearsal that we have, I think they're the best times rehearsals. I really do. Mm-hmm. I just think that's where you can have the real open connection where people are talking and experimenting. But actually, if there is a concert in the diary, then there is a time for realizing that we need to put something together that's going to be given out in a different kind of a way. And that does take a certain kind of understanding of time constraints, but also trying to keep the creative energy really up high without squashing it and saying, we have to do a run through right now. And yet still making sure that everybody's got the chops to feel really at ease and that they're most comfortable when we do the concert.
Exactly. And what you just said beautifully made me think of something that I hadn't thought of in such a way before, which is, I think that craft and preparation, because I just think of this naturally, it just evolved over the years, but maybe it needs to be said out loud. That craft of preparation is always creative. So in other words, when I'm dealing with a score, okay, whether it's for a jazz ensemble or one of Jacob's incredible pieces or with a wind or orchestra, whatever it is, I'm having a relationship with that score,
yeah.
me and that music. And what happens, and this is just the whole idea of analogy and all this stuff, that doesn't just like, it's not just winging things. It's a result of, I've spent
yes.
time, really a lot of time, hours thinking about this music, imagining in my head. And what I like to do is I analyze the music. Of course, it's this chord. It goes to this chord. This is the orchestration. That's the nuts and bolts. But for my money, I feel the most important thing is emotional analysis of music, feelingful, imaginative and feelingful analysis of the music is hugely important. And I think I don't see that as separate. As this, I think of it at the same time. And that's all I'm doing. I'm just taking all of that and then dispersing some of it
yes.
out into the world. And it, without that, it's not as though, okay, I've done the chord analysis and I've done the rhythmic analysis. Mm-hmm. Now I come. That's basic. Everybody has to know those things. But why is that there? And do you have a story about why that's there? You know, Roger, there's a famous, right? Roger Norrington, he apparently, I read this somewhere, he has written stories for each of the Beethoven 9 symphonies, like whole stories. Now, is he standing up in front of the London Symphony telling them the story of in his mind of Beethoven 5th? Not at all. But the fact that he'd be fired, but the fact that he's done that mental work, imaginative work, in addition to the horns are coupled with the clarinets here and it's a 5-7, that to me is huge. And I've not had a chance to watch him rehearse, but my guess is some of that story stuff is going to come out in one little thing and it's going to ignite, I mean, not specifically, that imagination. I mean, why else get together? I mean, if we're not going to share things, and likewise, I will often ask the students, you know, can you write a story about that phrase? I mean, why are we doing this if we're not engaging our imagination? It's just making sounds otherwise. So I think that's an important point, is that the preparation that we bring, the integrity that we bring, includes imaginative and creative work. And that seems so basic to say, but I think we have to say that, because I think in the creative art, it's always the composers are imaginative, you know, they're doing all these things, arrangers. Well, if the recreators aren't incredibly imaginative, it's nothing.
I love the idea of the recreators. I've never thought about that. I think that's really amazing. So, you know, you've got Bach, and he's written whatever he's written, and the musicians of the time, of the court, are getting together and they're playing it. And Bach's there saying, yeah, oh, actually, I might just change that chord, but no, that's really fine. Here we go. And then over the years, over the decades, over the centuries, we are recreators. And I think it's interesting because we can go back and think, well, it's really important that we think about what Bach had to deal with in those days and how it might have sounded. But maybe it's contentious to say that his music is so great that maybe that gives us license to really, really think about things in a slightly different way when we are recreating a piece of work in that way. Should we be frightened because somebody is going to say, you can't interpret it like that? Bach would turn in his grave. Or do we say that we're finding a respectful way to look at it in a different kind of a way? Is there such a thing as looking at something in a respectful way and finding a new way?
Absolutely. And, you know, of course, there's parameters. You know, you're not going to do, you know, things that are wildly out of the canon, you know, of performance practice. But why not? I mean, it's got to be, music isn't a staid, flat pond that doesn't ever travel. This music that we keep playing all the time, and then all the new music that needs to be played more. Mm-hmm. I think it all needs to have a creative element, all within, you know, basic parameters. But I mean, that's the reason why we want to own 15 recordings of Bach, or go to see this performance of this piece over and over again. Why? Because of who that performer is and what the imagination of that performer brings. I'm always struck that some of my favorite musicians, say in the Boston Symphony or other organizations or in jazz, if I have the chance to get to know them a little bit, they're also, well, Yo-Yo Ma is a perfect example.
Yes.
He is interested in so many things that are not directly about music.
Yes.
I mean, his imagination is massive. And that is partly because of his vast interest. And I find that the greatest artists, I say greatest, but I would say the artists that affect me the most emotionally, I'll put it that way.
Nice one.
The artists that wound me emotionally, that I want to be wound over and over again by, they are the people that are thinking beyond music. They might be experts in architecture, or they might have interests in things that, I mean, I just find it's not a, you know, that to me is fascinating. And I have to say, when I meet with this MIT students at the end of the semester, we have a playing exam. Now, yes, they come in, and because, you know, part of their grade, et cetera, they come in my office and I schedule a half an hour and I listen to them play some excerpts. Fine. And I do that. It sometimes turns into a lesson, but the best part of it is I ask them about their work that's not music. And sometimes they extend, I get into trouble with my schedule because what they're talking about is so fascinating to
me. Yes.
You know, and they're talking about things in many cases that's like changing the world or has the possibilities of changing the world. So I want to hear about that. Now, does that connect to music? Absolutely. I mean, because they're bringing that kind of a thing, the rigor of that, the emotion, their excitement, their emotional excitement about what they're working on with this drone or whatever it is, or this, you know, neurological situation. I am just endlessly, I can't understand it all. I need like translations, but I love it. And I think that all I'm saying is that I think we express ourselves in the totality of who we are. So
yes.
it's part of our job as human beings is to continue to expand who we are.
Yes.
And then we have the ability to be recreative, not just in music, but in any art, any creative endeavor, you know, that we engage in.
So you and I could literally carry on a conversation well into the early hours of both of our time zones. And I'm thinking about the blue whale who is so heavy to lift. And I'm thinking that in one sense, we could say that it's like lifting a blue whale, just really trying to be aware of all the wonderful creativity that we could be engaging in and all that weighs heavy on the heart. Or we could say, it's amazing that we have kind of blasted out some ideas together that certainly makes me realize that I do have a lot of responsibility to share the responsibility with others, that I can be more empathetic using all my senses. And rather than feeling that it's overwhelming, like lifting up the blue whale, actually, it's just an absolute privilege. So without wanting to take that analogy too far, I'd like to say that isn't it wonderful that you can look at every situation in more than one way? So lifting the blue whale can be a really positive and wonderful thing because we need to actually take them to a safer place to be. Mm-hmm. Or it could be just really overwhelming and something that we can never, ever do. So I think there are different ways to think about it. Oh, you've really just, you've opened my heart and mind anew. Thank you so very, very much.
Oh, thank you. It's been a great, great pleasure to spend time together and an honor to be a part of this fantastic series that you have.
Thanks so much for coming on board for this conversation. There are many more I can't wait to share with you, so do click the subscribe button. And if you want to come and find me on Instagram or Patreon, and I definitely hope to see you here really soon. Thanks so much.